the metta sutta, the Buddha's words of loving kindness. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be happy. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another, even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child. So with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness. One should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to false views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. So, the Brahmaviharas, the first one is metta. And the good thing about metta is it's like learning to have a friendly heart. So one of the precepts, five panchasila, one of the five precepts for lay people, is avoiding killing living beings. I was just thinking about that earlier today, that, you know, because what's the kind of a mind when we kill something? You know, we're angry, we're saying, I don't want you, and then we're killing it. So, you know, that's the definition of not having metta.
Actively. What about humane killing then?
Well, I mean, do we humanely kill our parents? You know, we think humanely killing animals, but we don't think about humanely killing humans.
Euthanasia?
Well, I mean, in Buddhism, it's like the problem with killing yourself early is we're all going to die eventually. And for whatever reason, when the body's breaking apart, usually it's the mind that's suffering that's the issue. So if we can learn to make peace with things and not react, then even the worst of sicknesses, you know, we can have mindfulness. Because if we're always, every life, something goes difficult and we're in pain and we want to kill ourselves, then eventually it's going to lead to one life where we commit suicide and we're not in pain. And then you fall from the human state in a bad way, and it's very hard. You know, so the human life is precious, And so rather than running from pain in life, if you look for the Buddha's teachings for monks, he has very specific teachings for monks when they're sick, because it's hard to meditate when you're sick. You know, you're there, you're in bed, you feel terrible, you can't move, people have to bring you food. You know, you can't sit there and do your normal meditation. So you have other contemplations where they're much more like contemplation of death or contemplation of the repulsiveness of food. And so they're much more coarse meditation objects. And there's about five of them. And the idea is that when you're sick, you need something coarse. You know, your mind isn't refined. And so, you know, when we're sick, you know, we want our meditation to be like what it was, then we're just causing ourselves suffering. So it's like, it's hard. Actually, one of the factors in practice is having a digestion that's neither too cool nor too warm and even and good for striving. So you have to have like the faith in the Buddha's teachings, have to have a good digestion, have to be relatively well. And so to have these things, it doesn't mean we need to be in perfect health, but we need to have our faculties balanced. And when the faculties are balanced, then it's easy to practice. But if for whatever reason, because there's some monks that just get very sick all the time. So it might be karma, or it might be that they don't have the right medicine. It might be just something that's coming up temporarily, or it might be a lifelong thing. So the idea is that when sickness comes, rather than running from it, we just have to accept it and then try and work with it. And so that's why the Buddha's teachings are quite good, because he teaches you how to act in different ways depending on the situation. So if the word bhavana is like mental cultivation. And so having something to think about is much easier to do when you're there and you're really sick and you're in pain. Once I had, I was on the way to hospital, I had some difficulties, and I used one of the contemplations that the right-hand disciple of the Buddha gave to a lay person on his deathbed. I'm not sure if it was Anapanasatipindika or Chittapala, but anyway, and it was going through all of the different senses and then the proliferation of the mind, and basically through that contemplation, you can just see that these are just sense contacts, you know, so you don't have to get involved with them. So it's just the mind going out into one of the senses, making a story, proliferating about it, and then you've got 100-fold times the amount of suffering. So by the time I got to the hospital, I was all peaceful and calm, and most of my pain had disappeared, and then they thought I was making it up. So there's one problem with it, but that's a good problem to have. So the idea is that, you know, the mind is stories. So, but if we haven't done the work before we get sick, then it's very hard to practice when we are sick. So that's why it's like the idea of saving for a rainy day. You know, if you wait till your house is burnt down to you know, save or get some insurance or something, it might be too late. But if you slowly have a bit of savings, or you're paying for some insurance when your house burns down, it's not the end of the world. You know, you've prepared for that disaster. And that's like our meditation. If we always attach to the peace and the joy, or just the seclusion, when those things disappear, then we're going to suffer. So that's why the Buddha had like the five regular recollections. Things like, you know, I'm of the nature to die, I'm of the nature to get old, I'm of the nature to sicken. That all that is mine, beloved and pleasing, will become otherwise, will become separated from me. And the idea is that, you know, we use the peace of our practice to contemplate these things. And then that's like us saving wisdom for that rainy day, because then when those things occur to us, then, you know, we're already familiar with them. You know, we've already thought about them. We already have some solutions at hand. So it's not just like, you know, our whole life is destroyed, but we're just like, oh, you know, this is something that we know about, that we've thought about, that we've seen into. And then that's like the preparation. And so that work that we did using our meditations, using our wisdom, means that we can look at things in a different way. Because it's like when you look at the grief people have, you know, when they lose a loved one or they lose their possessions or they lose their job, and these are all just worldly conditions. And it's because we haven't prepared our hearts for these truths, even though we all know everybody who's born one day is going to die. Somehow we never think about that. And our world, particularly in the West, we're so insulated. I think in the old days when they used to light a fire, you'd have soot all through your house and, you know, you'd stink of smoke. And now, you know, we just turn on the electric oven or whatever. So we're very insulated in our lives and we have lots of convenience. But, you know, we should also use our time in a way where we're preparing our hearts so that when these things come, we're not, it's not a disaster, you know. It's something that we know it's a nature. And then the Buddha took that further as well. It's like when we see a sick person, rather than being humiliated and disgusted, that's the natural nature of the mind, because, you know, we don't want to see a sick person, but we turn it back on ourselves and we say, this body too is of the nature to sicken, or this body too is of the nature to die. So then rather than reacting to our experience, being humiliated or disgusting, we're using our experience to learn. And then when we see that aversion there, then we know we need to do more work, that we're not ready for these things. And the other thing that came up today was truthfulness. Because there's, you know, sometimes you get these ideas about having a white lie, or I think Plato had something that about a political lie that was okay. But, I mean, when the Buddha taught these things to his son Rahula, I think Rahula was 7, and the Buddha may have caught him lying or something, and he told Rahula that, you know, not even to lie, even for the sake of a joke. Because the problem with lying is we break people's trust, you know. So then we don't know if they're joking or lying. And then also, the Buddha said, so if there was like water in a jug, and then you were to throw that water away, you know, you turn the jug upside down, that's like throwing away our spiritual wealth. So the problem with lying is somebody who lies, there's nothing that they can't do. So even though it's seems like something small, actually when somebody who can't lie because of the integrity in their heart, then that person is truly trustworthy, you know. And it doesn't mean that, you know, sometimes we might speak too much or something and we lie accidentally, but even that can be purified over time. But we're talking here about intentional lying. So if somebody says, come now, you know, tell the truth, and, you know, and you would always tell the truth, and you'd be somebody who stands up for truth. And then, and that means that, you know, there is integrity and trust. And then it goes further than that, that then that's the basis for determination. Because when there's satya, which is truthfulness, then we can start to have determinations, and that's how we strengthen ourselves. We make a determination to meditate every day, or a determination to cut out critical thinking or obsessive thinking or whatever it is. And then we start to use that water that's in the jug, our spiritual wealth, as like a bank account that we can use to perfect our hearts. So we make a determination, and then we try and stick to that. And if we're not ready to make a determination yet, we don't, because we realize that will start to break our truthfulness. And one of the big problems in this world is that, you know, the world's addicted to television and media, and all these things are based on sensationalism. So it's always like drugs, lying, all the bad things, you know, because that's what people find interesting. But then in that process, people are forgetting about living integrity. I was quite surprised when I found that in Plato's teachings. So these things go right back into our kind of early schools of thought that this is an okay thing. And, you know, when I was young, I used to lie to get out of trouble. And it wasn't until I was an adult, maybe 12 years ago, that I just turned my life around. And truthfulness is something that leaves a blameless mind, because then you start to be able to trust yourself. You don't have this kind of cobwebs of actions in your mind. Like, oh, what did I say? What did I not say? What did I do? What did I not do? And it's not that we all have to be perfect, but just this kind of intention to move in that direction really, really makes things a lot simpler. And the idea of the precepts, the reason why the Buddha taught them, these are the things that prevent people from being reborn in the lower realms, so the animal realms, the ghost realms, the hell realms. And if somebody truly did those five precepts, the Panchasila, to the level of where they would rather die than break them, then that would be enough to be reborn in a heavenly realm, just keeping those five things. So they're not small. But it really all starts with truthfulness, because if we don't have truthfulness, how can we trust ourselves? But once we start to have that truthfulness, then we can see the power of that. Then the other precepts start to become easier. And then eventually it starts to become determinations in the mind. For example, like sexual misconduct. You know, I think a lot of people, when they think of these precepts, they think of it on a physical level. But actually it's on the level of the mind. So somebody wouldn't even have sexual misconduct in the mind. You know, somebody wouldn't even have the intention to lie in their mind. But when we start practicing, you know, we're starting with coarse things. And then the more we practice, then the more things refined they become. And then the more refined they become, then you start to find that this metta, which is like boundless friendliness, is something that's actually accessible to the heart. And when we're meditating, when we're practicing, we're not doing any harm to anybody. You know, even if we're having to deal with the onslaught of our own thoughts, we're just sitting in our chair. We're just sitting on our cushion. You know, we're actually adding more peace to the world. And in Buddhism, we have we have heavenly beings, and the more people practice, they start to get looked after by these heavenly beings. So that's why it's nice to have a little shrine in your house or a little space, so then when you practice, that becomes like a little sacred space. Now, that's somewhere where those sankharas, those thoughts, that's what you're doing. I used to just have a spot next to my bed on the side that I didn't walk, and I had a little Buddha there and my cushion, and often my cat climbing on me. But at least then you got one little spot, and it doesn't matter what goes on when you meditate, but just that intention to show up and keep practicing. And then also I found having a little spiritual journal. So sometimes after the meditation, to kind of, you know, investigate things, you know, write things down, see where we're going, you know, what are our values, you know, what are our goals. Because the problem with thinking is that it's a never-ending theater. So if we can start to use directive thought, where, you know, when we make decisions, we know we're making them. We make them at a time where we're peaceful and calm, where we're not being influenced by bad emotions. Then we can start to move our lives in a good direction. But if we're just like idly making decisions while we're driving the car, listening to the radio, thinking how terrible our boss is, then, you know, they may not be very good decisions. And then I was speaking with giving a friend a guided meditation the other day. And sometimes in life we face really difficult people. You know, they might be narcissistic, they might be angry, they might be this, they might be that. But when we learn to have metta in our hearts, you know, we can see past all that. It's just another being. You know, we don't have to be upset. We don't know what their upbringing was or what their family life was or where they're coming from. And when we put down those stories and we start to see people as people, it doesn't matter what they say or do. We have the right to be kind towards that person. You know, we don't have to be doormats, but we don't have to get angry. And when we get to that point, then that's when we start to have true metta. And then when we look in our hearts, you know, metta is like a luminous sun. And even if the great Mara, the great demon of the universe, was come up to us, you know, we'd still just, you know, smile at them, wish them well. Because, you know, that's just where they're at this time. You know, that's just their actions at the moment. Beings, until they realize enlightenment, beings are still a continuation, they're a process. And so, you know, why should we get angry that another person's currently made some bad decisions or they're caught up in some bad cycles, you know? And then and that frees us. So then even if the world is crazy around us and other people are beside themselves with strange ideas or difficulties, we can be in the eye of the storm. We don't have to be so emotionally involved with, you know, the stories of the day. Because in Buddhism we have the Dharma is timeless. You know, it doesn't matter what universe, it doesn't matter what Buddha or Pacheka Buddha. It doesn't matter if, you know, the Dharma has vanished from the world because there's no Buddha around. Or it's a period of expansion or contraction, or it was 92 universes ago or a million universes ago. The laws of Dharma, the laws of truth are always the same. That we always have access to being a better person, to seeking the path of enlightenment, to being kind, to being generous, to being gentle. And so when we choose that better side of ourselves, then, you know, that's really the best thing that we can do. Because then we're not looking outside ourselves. We're not looking at the problems of other people. And, you know, sometimes at the other monastery I stay at, you hear these people having burnouts and loud music and stuff. And, you know, I always just think kind thoughts to them. You know, they're just doing what they're doing. You could get angry and, you know, disappointed that somebody's disturbing your meditation. But just think they're just another person. One day they will die, and who knows, they could be the next best prime minister in the world. We just don't know, you know. So all these stories of the mind, I always recall King Ashoka, because he's the king who spread Buddhism into the world a generation or two or three after the Buddha, a few generations later. And I always think, well, at that time, he was a bloodthirsty ruler. He killed his 15 brothers to become king, and he conquered by war and blood, and it was terrible. And then eventually he became a Buddhist. You know, he met a Buddhist monk, and it changed his life. So imagine if that Buddhist monk, rather than practicing, had gone around telling the world how bad that king was. You know, where would the world be today? So because that particular monk that the story I remember is there was a monk walking across a battlefield, you know, just calmly walking across all these corpses, and as if, you know, he's walking through a field of flowers, as monks do, you know, they're just sense restrained walking along. It doesn't matter what they're doing, because their mind is centered in their own heart. And then King Ashoka went and asked him, you know, who he was. He said that he was a Buddhist monk. And that was enough to change him to becoming a Buddhist. It was just like this one simple thing. So, but if we never, that's why as Buddhists, we shouldn't be, as Buddhist monks, we shouldn't be involved with politics or taking sides, because people are just a bundle of decisions. And we never know when those decisions are going to change. Could be next week, could be next year, could be 1,000 lives from now. But if we always see that spark in people's hearts, and then always give people the benefit of the doubt, then that's like true metta. You know, just as we would treat ourselves, as we would treat our loved ones, so we try to treat all beings. And then that means we're associating with the best of people. We're always giving people the benefit of the doubt. And then even if they come to us and we have terrible situations, you know, we don't have to be involved with that weather system. You know, we can just be calm and peaceful in our own hearts. And it's difficult to do, but then people react to that because we're being kind to them. You know, it's usually when people react to us, it's because we still have some grudge in our hearts. But there's some people, no matter what you do, even some people went and blamed the Buddha, and he was the Buddha. So it's like praise and blame is always going to be there. And so on the other extreme, when difficulties come along, then we just say, well, these are just the worldly winds. You know, this praise and blame, gain and loss, success and failure, happiness and suffering. And these things are just a part of the world. And so if we get upset at them every time they come along, then, you know, we're just like just reacting to everything in our lives. And that reaction is just another form of suffering. So instead, I always love one of the Buddha's teachings, and he said that a rare person in the world is somebody who is thankful and grateful. Because, I mean, it doesn't matter what religion they are, doesn't matter what walk of life they are. If somebody who is truly thankful and grateful, it doesn't matter what happens in their life, they're always going to look for the things to be thankful and grateful about. So that's somebody who's quite spiritually evolved. Now, it's a difficult thing to do. They don't have any criticism. They're not looking for the bad in other people. They're always looking to be thankful and grateful. And so that's like a symbol of a true person, somebody who has that ability. And and then when the Buddha taught the teachings, one day there were some monks, I think they were arguing over a spittoon. And spittoon is like where we put our wastewater or whatever in it. And I think one monk hadn't cleaned the spittoon properly. And the other one was getting irate at this monk. And I said, you're a terrible monk, don't you know the Buddha's Vinaya, and you should have cleaned this and you should have cleaned that. And then eventually it got back to the Buddha. And then the Buddha tried to teach them. And then I think they even told the Buddha, you know, to go away basically. And eventually the Buddha gave this teaching called the Simile of the Saw. And it has some great Dhamma in there, but the main part about the metta is, you know, the gist of it is, you know, if somebody shouts at you, then you should be grateful that they didn't throw sticks at you. If somebody throws sticks at you, then you should be grateful that they didn't throw rocks at you. If somebody throws rocks at you, you should be grateful they didn't stab you. If somebody stabs you, well, you should be grateful they didn't cut you up in little pieces. If somebody cuts you up in little pieces, well, then you think, well, their karma is their own. So there's never any, and the Buddha said, somebody who even has a single thought of ill will, if you were having your arms chopped off towards that person, isn't following the Buddha's teachings. So, I mean, that just shows you the level of it. And then there was this simile of a well-oiled cat skin bag. In those days, obviously, they make bags out of cats. Anyway, but the simile is that normally a cat skin bag, if you hit it with rocks and sticks, it would make noise. But if it's well oiled, if you hit it with rocks and sticks, those sounds are very soft. They don't have an impact. And so that's like the simile of our mind. So you notice when we're angry, when we're irritated, the mind is sharp. So we need to make our minds like a well-oiled catskin bag. And that's one of the, he has some great similes in there, but that was one of them. And just back to the side of meditation, why I talk so much about the metta is one of the things I regularly ask myself when I'm practicing a lot is, do I have metta? Because right? When metta is there, then the other Brahmaviharas are there. When the Brahmaviharas are there, then we're not going to suffer when we're practicing. you know, it's not going to be difficult. And so that's it's a worthy thing of contemplating, because if we're sitting there and we're getting angry or frustrated or lost, quite often we don't have that metta in our heart. But the more we reflect on it, and we use wisdom to overcome those irritations, you know, it could just be a dog barking, or it could be the way that the neighbor leaves the mail or something, or whatever those petty little things is our minds latch onto. And we use it to reflect back on ourselves, that this is an opportunity to give up, this is an opportunity to be kind. And one of the reflections that I often use is, you know, before I go say something to somebody, you know, am I saying it with, out of irritation, or am I saying it with the heart of goodness? Because if I'm saying it out of irritation, usually I'll wait. It might take like a month or two before finally that irritation goes, and then I can actually say what I was going to say. But if we're just speaking out of irritation, then we're criticizing other people. You know, we don't like being criticized. So it's just a teaching to learn to have a heart of metta. Sometimes we have to wait. You know, it's not the right time. And then to encourage people in our lives to be truthful, you know, to have metta. Because, you know, it's always easy to look at the faults in the world around us. But if we can encourage people to be good people, then that's a lot of our suffering gone right there. You know, we don't have to be perfect. And that's why I like King Ashoka. If you look up on the internet, King Ashoka's edicts, they're like the pillars that he put around his land. And a lot of them were just, you know, respect your mother and father, learn about your neighbor's religion, and be kind, be zealous, be humble. And they're very simple universal dhammas. Now, these are the kind of things that we should encourage, you know, our leaders of our countries, our neighbors, our friends, our family. We encourage everybody in kind of universal truth. And we do have respect for our elders. We do have respect for our leaders. And we have respect for ourselves. And then that means when we come to meditate, when we come to practice, you know, we're not going to be fighting all of these hindrances in our heart, because we genuinely are, already have this kind of luminous heart with metta and generosity and thankfulness. And we have the wisdom to see when the defilements are tricking us into some other story. So that's the Dhamma talk. Now we'll do a guided meditation. Okay, just take a moment to come into the present. Just find a comfortable but upright position. Just the intention of having the spine relatively upright and an inner sense of being upright. Relaxed but centered. And start by relaxing the toes, the soles of the feet. The back of the soles of the feet, up into the ankles and the front of the feet. Back out to the tips of the toes. Just relax the toes. Just putting the mind into the feet, into the toes, into the ankles. Letting go of any tension. And then moving up from the ankles into the lower legs. The shins, the calves, the muscles. Everything in the lower legs, centered and relaxed. Into the base of the knees, inside the knees, lower thighs, middle of the thighs, the upper thighs, the hips, the weight of the body onto the seat of the cushion. In the waist, relax from the waist down to the toes. And become aware of the belly as it rises and falls with the breath. I might notice the energy of the breath starting to wake up a bit. Sometimes as we relax, we start to get dull. Just see if we can notice the energy of the in-breath and the out-breath. As the belly rises and falls. Waking up to the in-breath. Waking up to the out-breath. Relax the lower back and spine. Out into the sides. Spreading up into the middle back and spine. Out into the sides of the torso. And the upper back. The shoulder blades, the spine. Out into the sides of the torso, and spreading up into the shoulders. Just visualize all the knots and the tension and the stress unwinding and letting go in the shoulders. Dropping, relaxing, opening, freeing up. Relax the upper arms, the elbows, tips of the elbows. Moving down into the lower arms, into the wrists, the backs of the hands, the palms of the hands. The fingers, the thumbs and the fingertips. And the diaphragm, the solar plexus. I visualize a white light spreading through the torso. It's freeing up of the breath. Relaxing the upper torso, the chest, the heart. It's like a blue sky spreading through the heart. Soft smile. Become aware of the lungs as they fill up with an in-breath and empty with an out-breath. Filling up, energizing, emptying, letting go. In-breath is the present moment. The out-breath is the present moment. Energizing with the in-breath. Letting go with the out-breath. Thank you. collarbone relaxing, the neck, the throat. Even the wind passing through the neck. Tip of the chin relax, the jaw relax. The lower gums and teeth, the upper gums and teeth. The tongue down to the root, the lips. Might notice a slight smile at the corners of the mouth. Between the upper lip and the nostrils, relaxed. The nostrils, the sides of the nose, the ridge of the nose, the upper cheeks and cheekbones, the temples. Might notice a slight smile at the corners of the eyes, the eyebrows, the eyelids, the eyes themselves. Just become aware of how the eyes feel right now. Bring kindness to them. Be present to how they are right now. And the Buddha once mentioned, when we meditate, to relax the body, relax the eyes, and then the mind not to flow out to the asavas and to the world. So now the body is relatively relaxed. Let's see if we can really relax the eyes. We have our physical eyes, also our inner eye. Relax the eyes deeply. And spreading the relaxation up into the forehead. Like a breath of fresh air spreading across the forehead. Across the top of the head, the ears, the back of the head. The whole of the head, the whole of the body. At ease. With acceptance. Content with the body as it is. And let the body look after itself for the rest of the meditation. If it needs to move or cough or do anything, it can look after itself. And set up intention. Bring ourselves to our meditation object. If we have a main meditation object, a theme, now is the time to take that up. For those who wish, I'll give a guided meditation. Breath meditation. It's good to choose a place that's comfortable. Some people at the lip, some of the nostrils, some of the chest, the belly, roof of the mouth, or following the flow of the breath. Just choose a means that suits ourselves. Seems natural. Breathing in, aware of the in-breath. Feelings of the in-breath. Breathing out. Aware of the out-breath. The feelings of the out-breath. Just this much. It's good enough. Give up any demands or stories, concerns. This kind presence with the in-breath. This kind presence with the out-breath. welcoming the in-breath with friendliness, welcoming the out-breath with friendliness. Leaving judgments, criticisms, and stories at the door. What's the length of the in-breath? What's the length of the out-breath? Start to try and become familiar. Like when we're talking with a friend, how we're interested. Likewise, we try and be interested in the in-breath. What's its length, its texture, its feeling, its temperature? And likewise with the out-breath. Like a skilled turner works with wood. Find the mind is particularly busy at all, you can always use a mantra as well. Bud, Do, or Me, Ta. Using a syllable with the in-breath and a syllable with the out-breath. Be very helpful for some people. Other people, just the feeling and that quietness is enough. See if you can be aware of the whole of an in-breath, the whole of an out-breath. In-breath is the present moment. The out-breath is a present moment. And see if you can tranquilize the in-breath. Tranquilize the out-breath. Sense of serenity and ease. Really allowing the heart to settle, like a bird snug in the nest. It's tranquility with the in-breath. Tranquility with the out-breath. And a sense of smiling with the in-breath. Sense of easeful enjoyment. Sense of smiling with the out-breath. is however feels most comfortable. Just like sometimes we smile to ourselves or a friend and smile to the in-breath. Smile to the out-breath. Enjoying the in-breath. Enjoying the out-breath. Enjoying the in-breath, enjoying the out-breath, like a dial, we tune in to what's suitable to ourselves, there's a whole range of feeling, from subtle, right up, whatever feels most comfortable. Enjoying the in-breath, enjoying the out-breath. We still any lingering movements of the heart towards action and thought. This enjoyment, we bring this stillness to our hearts, this quiet stillness and ease. And I usually say either unshakable peace, unshakable stillness. At first, just gladden the heart. A smile in the heart, letting go of all worries, gladdening the heart, breathing in, gladdening the heart, breathing out, letting any lingering stories dissolve. Still with the feeling of the breath, gladdening the heart, breathing in, gladdening the heart, breathing out. And with this fullness of presence, either unshakable peace or unshakable stillness. Unshakable peace breathing in. Unshakable peace breathing out. As if the whole world was to vanish. And this profound peace is all that remains with the breath. Unshakable peace breathing in. Unshakable peace breathing out. I'll be silent now for the next few minutes. Just keep this kind awareness tuning in to unshakable peace. this unshakable peace, freeing the mind, breathing in, freeing the mind, breathing out. Any difficulties in the heart, just letting them all go. Sense of freedom and ease. Freeing the heart, breathing in. Freeing the heart, breathing out. Untying, unbounded, shackles falling away. It's this luminous heart of metta. Freeing the mind, breathing in. Freeing the mind, breathing out. This is profound peace and profound freedom. Freeing the mind, breathing in. Freeing the mind, breathing out. The things that limit and bind us, letting them all go. Sense of gratitude for ourselves, the willingness to practice. That it is a struggle and strive just to take the time to practice. So we should always encourage ourselves. And we share the goodness of this meditation with ourselves, with those here today, those in this region, those in Australia and the world, the heavenly beings, the animals, the beings we like, the beings we're indifferent to, and the beings that we have problems with, all beings everywhere, including ourselves, we share a heart of boundless metta. May we take this contentment and peace with us into our lives. That's the end of the meditation. Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration.
Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may the spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile,
May all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease and all harmful states of mind until I realize Nibbana. In every kind of birth, may I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the perfection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble lord. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled. Sorry, sorry. A little blessing.
Bhavatu sabba mangala arakantu sabba devata sabba buddha rupavena sadasuti bhavantute. Bhavatu sabba mangalam rakkhantu sabba devata sabba dhamma rupavena sada suti bhavantu te. Bhavatu sabba mangalam rakkhantu sabba devata sabba sanghanupavena sada suti bhavantu te.
Thank you all for coming.